Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 421. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a wonderful show for you this week. Let me introduce our guest to you. Sean Howell is the co-founder and president of Hornet, the world's premier gay social network. Hornet was founded in 2011 with the mission to build the digital home for the gay community. It has grown to 25 million total users by utilizing cutting-edge technology for their dating platform and producing original editorial content to connect a community around the world with common interests. Hornet provides a user experience that, you know, has rocketed it to number one in a lot of key markets like France and Russia and Brazil and Turkey and Taiwan, and expanding their already considerable usership here in the United States. They have some new initiatives that we're excited to discuss, but first, Sean, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
I'm really happy to be here. It's my first time as guest, but I, of course, know your show well.
Well, we are thrilled to have you, Sean. When little Sean Howell was running around growing up, was he saying, I'm totally going to co-found a digital platform for people?
No, I definitely don't think so. I think I was interested in growing avocados and raising chickens.
That's amazing. I don't even know if that's a metaphor or that's a real thing.
No, I'm sure a young Sean, that's all I dreamed about. But I think if you asked the young gayish version of Sean, he might have told you this is exactly what I should be doing.
So talk to me about work leading up to this. What positions have you held in your life that led you to this point of saying in 2011, I'm going to co-found this new gay social network?
It's in some ways very unglamorous, but also perhaps the interesting backstory of any, you know, bootstrap startup. I was a financial analyst before starting Hornet, and I worked in corporate America and just simply happened to use many gay predecessors to smartphones. Like I used gay.com and other social networks online. There's something called D-List that doesn't exist anymore. There was an MTV LGBT network called Downlink, and that's how I made a lot of friends when I was in college and went to a small Lutheran college where there weren't other gay students. We had a couple of lesbians, was about as lucky as I could get. And so connecting online was important for me, and I had a lot of friends who worked in technology, and I just thought that gay men deserved a better experience online.
Yeah.
And so Hornet was started just for fun. And we built a product by gay technologists, friends from Microsoft, Zynga, LinkedIn. We came together and we drew on a piece of paper what we thought the ideal gay app would look like. And some of the early features were simply things we knew could and should exist.
Yeah.
Most of my friends traveled a lot and volunteered overseas, and so we wanted an app where you could easily change your location to whatever country you were going with. And that's the reason that Hornet today is probably the largest gay international social network, is because we had these early features that were just simply based on what the founders wanted.
Yeah. I feel that there's a gap here that I would like to fill in the blanks for some people, because I've watched enough Shark Tank to know that there is a disconnect between having an idea and actually making it happen. How did you actually fill in that gap of, all right, we have this great idea. You know what? Let's actually do it and not just be sitting around talking about it.
Looking back, sometimes it's easy to forget the hard times, but in some ways, seeing many of my friends struggle with their own startups, I live in San Francisco now, we got lucky. We built something that really had a pent-up demand for. And the first month of launching, we had 100,000 users. And that's
Whoa.
Just an untold story. And until recent history, we ran the company totally based out of revenue, and we just did a big fundraise just to take the app for the to the next level, which is why we're talking today, is because we wanted to continue to fulfill that original vision and invest in making the product even better.
I know that so much of your role in starting out was all about marketing and sales. When there is competition out there, how do you go about separating Hornet from the other apps that are out there? Because there are other ones out there and they do different things. And so I have a sense at least that you have to establish yourself in a market. I'm a college professor and even I know that much. How do you go about doing that?
Sure. I think once in a while you can take on a competitor by building a better mousetrap and just trying to outcompete them at their own game. We really thought something was missing in the marketplace, some way for you to go online and have a little bit of romance or to have an intelligent conversation. And so we built an app totally based around that. We have hashtags inside of our profiles. So if you go to my profile, it's not a very popular hashtag, but Italo Calvino is one of my favorite writers. He's on my profile. And I think now with what the version of the app we just launched, which took 3 quarters in the making, about $2 million of engineering investment. We put native content inside the app. We had already been acquiring and building the largest LGBT newsroom in the world, and now we've been able to plug that into the app in a way that makes sense, both in terms of a social feed. So if I like an article that's about who the new Secretary of Education is, anyone who's following my profile can see that and engage with it. And so that's just nothing like any of the other apps that are out there. So you don't just have to talk about my washboard abs if I had them to strike up a conversation with me. You can talk to me about the topics you can obviously see I'm interested in.
Did I just mishear you? Did you propose the topic of how much you enjoy the new Secretary of Education?
Not at all. What I do think is important is that we have LGBT journalists who are writing about that.
Nice.
How the New York Times might cover who the new Secretary of Education is, it's very different than the way that an LGBT journalist attacking that story for an LGBT audience is. And unfortunately, all media in this country has felt increasing pressure partly by digital revolution, not because there's websites that are making news easier to compete with. There's just more and more mediums and things moved to our smartphones. And it's very hard for some institutions to adapt and move quickly to. And so we've seen a lot of LGBT media close in recent years. And we've been lucky enough not to acquire old technology, but to acquire the talent that was producing there. In fact, I'm sitting in a room with one of our editors right this moment at our New York office. He was the editor-in-chief of Next Magazine in New York, Alex Casala.
Yeah.
Stephen Horbelt runs our content team, who was running Frontiers in Los Angeles. Christophe Marte, who was the founding editor of Tattoo in France, runs our European news desk. Andre Fischer, who created G Magazine, Junior Magazine, several other titles in South America, and later founded Mix Brazil, is our country manager for Brazil. We have just lots of talented journalists all over the world, and we now surface that content inside of our app. And that's where the audience is, and it's really powerful, both for users to get to have access to global LGBT reporting, which was something that might have just been a dream before, having multilingual LGBT reporting coming from native Brazil, Portuguese speakers in Brazil, reporting on Brazil and reporting that in French and Spanish and Chinese. Those are all things that happen at Hornet now, which I'd have to really stretch hard to find even a dual language LGBT media. And so this all is coming right at a time when we saw a lot of publications closing. And it keeps me up at night because I think not only have we just accomplished so much, but there's even more to accomplish in how we serve markets in some of the most remote parts of the world, or places that are just facing their own challenges and problems, like Indonesia, Chechnya, and perhaps Turkey.
Yeah. And just so we're on the same page, because I would hate for you and I to be having two different conversations, I am now officially counting this as my interview to be one of the LGBT journalists for Hornet. So I don't know what you're thinking, but just wanted to be clear with you about what's happening.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so hope I'm doing well. All right, are we ready for the question, right? We have to get this question out of the way, Sean, because it looms over my mind and it looms over so many minds in the LGBTQ community. Are these apps, I want to say affecting, we know that they're affecting, are these apps killing the way that we as a community interact socially?
You know, I think that's always going to be a great question.
Yeah.
What impact does technology have on any aspect of what we do, whether it's just individually how a tool can impact us or what other changes in the environment can exist. We recently did some reporting on around the topic of our gay bars closing because of the apps. Really interesting findings there. And what I will say that it's probably the most interesting part of this topic is to think about how many more conversations people can now have that are gay because of technology, whether that's in a place like Indonesia or that's a place like in Kentucky or even just outside of a big city, like just outside of San Francisco. There's plenty of urban mid-sized towns that if you're a young gay man, you're not going to have that many uplifting conversations. At least I didn't when I was in junior high and high school and graduating. And I think if you go back even further, the opportunities for people to meet, you know, were really limited. And, you know, one of our users explained to me, he was about 45 years old. And he was telling me that when he was in college in Bozeman, the idea of where to go to meet someone was like he had to imagine he would have to go to a truck stop or something. It turned out he ended up dating a professor at a school. But I think that there, not only is it easier for people who didn't have access to people like them before, but even if you're in a city like New York, you can just meet more people than you could otherwise. And not everyone wants to go to a bar and get a cocktail and meet their friends that way. I think we kind of would be forcing that onto people if it wasn't for technology.
Yeah.
And it's not always the best environment to, you know, put our best foot forward, and half the population are probably introverts. So I think technology is doing the opposite. I think young people are coming out sooner. I think we're able to have more. I think, you know, something that may have changed LGBT as a community the most is just the success of antiviral drugs and HIV. And as we see success there, we now need to find new things to build community around. And but I think in general, apps are being really helpful to people making new friends and keeping in touch.
Nice. Again, listeners, we are here with Sean Howell, the co-founder and president of Hornet. So let's talk about this editorial content a bit more. How do you respond to people who would say, that's just not what people are going on the apps for, Sean? We don't care about the editorial content. We're just looking to meet the next person or looking to meet the love of our life. How do you respond to that?
Sure. Well, we're a data-driven company, and so the answer is a bit boring. You know, we surface content that we think is really relevant, and we definitely prioritize popular content. But our editorial team has the editor's picks, and we make sure that we're exposing our community to the news that matters. And I think we have a sense of purpose around that. Around what people are doing on the app, that question's always surprised people. And most people are going on there and having very long conversations and sometimes talking for over a year before they meet each other. And some, you know, we can kind of see in the data that, you know, men in London are falling asleep probably with their phones in their hand, having conversations at 1 a.m. And I think if anything, you know, modern life can be a little bit lonely, and being able to connect with someone and have a conversation is one of the pain points that Hornet solves for people.
Yeah.
So I think the data constantly surprises people. I think that's one of the most interesting things about my job. So I'm really excited about this content. The content was already popular on when we had a standalone news platform before, and now that we've put it inside the app, it's even more popular.
So how do you balance that out with marketing? And I do want to push you on this a little bit because I love the editorial content. Again, I'm treating this as a job interview. I want to create some of it for you. But at the same time, right, if we go on the App Store right now and we click on Hornet, what it would appear to be doesn't have necessarily that editorial content. We have, you know, the three pictures that pop up of a ton of guys and in particular one guy with those washboard abs. So how do we find that middle ground of you guys have such incredibly talented writers there and you're going to have, I mean, the pedigree that you listed is just wonderful and it makes me so happy to hear that. But we also know that that's maybe not exactly what brings people in. And so we have to market things in different ways. How do you find that middle ground? Because I want you to be successful and financially viable as well.
Absolutely. I think the breadth and volume of content that our editorial team is producing is creating huge exposure for us. And I'm super excited about the independence that they have and their sense of the zeitgeist of the community. And in some ways, what we think of would be the best marketing oftentimes isn't true. And so once again, that's a data-driven point. But just kind of the volume of stories every day creates huge exposures for our brand. And that's one of the reasons we moved everything into a single brand. We think that Hornet's always been the social network, and now that the content has been come into us in a kind of native fashion, and that's kind of industry speak for something that just looks organic inside the product. I think we've had strong growth before. The early data is showing that it's being successful at helping drive our numbers. So I think that part's going really well. And I think if anything, if you know, once in a while you have an enticing advertisement, that's get balanced by, you know, this really rigorous content. We recently did a billboard campaign attacking hate in the country. And if you look at those billboards, it wasn't two guys in washboard abs. It was actually, we were tackling two conversations at once. It was a multiracial couple that looked like, you know, your ordinary neighbor kid that you might actually see in that community. And we put that all over the country and had great response and started and ignited the kind of conversations we wanted. So I think there's always going to be a mixture of, you know, celebrating kind of the sex positive elements of our community as well as the intellectual ones. And I think many times people have that same stereotype that gay men are just meeting at the opera.
Right. Well, you actually dovetailed nicely into the next part of this is that we hear increasingly, and we've heard it throughout time, right? Like we've heard it for 30, 40 years about racism within the gay community, but a new facet of that that's come up so much in the past couple of years is racism that might exist on these apps, right? And as a professor who mostly teaches about race, I'm always going to be particularly fascinated by this. Do you all feel a responsibility to address that, or is it really more on the users?
It's 100% on the users in the terms of where things originate, but in terms of sense of obligation, that is 120% us.
Yeah.
And we've been working on this for a long time. Ever since we launched the app, I grew up in San Francisco, and it's a very multiracial town. And I always was well aware of the racial divide that exists in the gay community. So that's why when we created our community standards before we launched the app, racism wasn't allowed. Any expression of it, whether it was passively in your profile saying something like no blacks or no Asians, that could get you banned for life. If a user reported you as being racist, that would as well. We use some technology to look for racial, hate expressions in 17 languages. So there's, you know, on a daily basis, there might be 4,000 different queries that we're scrubbing through the profiles to make sure that we don't have people who are, whether they're doing it overtly or passively, making a negative experience that can be traumatic for other users. But in terms of what I think is, you know, the healthiest thing we can do is find ways of building resilience and building affirmation within the community. And so that's people within their own, people who represent the same backgrounds or the community in general reaffirming each other. And so we work hard in different ways to build that community. We do some editorial content around that. We try to be smart about our marketing. And no one's perfect. We're always looking for new ideas and ways for us to help that and think about that. We just had a piece by a professor at Virginia Tech, Woodrow Wilson, write about that. Our health and wellness expert, Alex Gardner, has been writing about it for a long time, and he helps us think critically about how we can use technology to empower and uplift, and also to make sure that we don't have kind of a negative environment.
Yeah. It's so funny when you say that, of building the better mousetrap and always looking for new ideas, and that's a good thing. There's a part of me, Sean, I'm hoping there's just some small part of you that's like, or could we not? Could everything just stop developing and we just go with what we have right now because it's really, really good? I'm exhausted by thinking about constantly integrating new ideas.
You know, that I think that's true, but the technology is not asleep. It's going to get better. Everything continues to progress. We always launch, you know, we launch a new version of the app every 10 days, whether that's trying to speed things up or make dramatic improvements like the recent product launch or making chat better. Those are all things that we want to keep making better for our users. And I know my engineers get excited and get a thrill out of creating something new and then seeing the numbers light up the next day.
I love it.
It's great to have a common watering hole, and I think that is something that we really imagine is our future, is to be a digital home for the gay community. Claiming that puts a high bar on what we need to continue to deliver, and I'm excited about the future. We recently launched a community platform to help our users participate in creating and building our app. More. We always had beta testers, but now there's a way for more and more people to access being beta testers. There's a way for people to be contributors on our stories platform. And there's ability for people to help translate our content, which means that we'll be able to offer even more content in Farsi and Arabic and additional languages, Turkish. We do that in a very limited way now, but I'm looking forward to that growing and being as robust as possible.
In my head, there is some sort of app softball league where you guys are taking on the Scruff team and the Grindr team, and I don't know who's winning, but is there any truth to that? How often do you talk to the folks from the other apps?
We have reason to interact from time to time. I think in some ways, whether we have just slight overlap between our user bases or really extensive overlap, I think one common issue is that gay men nowhere in the world have 100% equality, and we are the biggest gay media that's out there, and it's important for us to come together and work for the rights of our users. So I do think that there's times for us to interact on issues of critical importance.
Yeah.
In terms of our apps, mm-hmm. I think if you use our app and use their apps, you would see that they're just very different. The sense of community is different, and we all serve the marketplace in a slightly different way, if not a dramatically different way. So we do get to interact, and we're all gay technologists, and I think that's another subgroup within a subgroup. That's an important one, and technology is going to be a big part of the future economy, and I think it's important that we see LGBT leadership there, and I think that's something that's materializing.
Well, tell everybody where they can go to learn more about Hornet.
Yep, they can look for us in the App Store. That's the easiest way. You just type in Hornet, H-O-R-N-E-T, and we will come up, and you can meet our 25 million users. You can also access us on the web, hornetapp.com.
There it is. You guys do such a good job just talking about that this is a meeting place for gay people. And I don't care about the whole, you know, people saying, oh, it's killing society. I don't actually think that it is. It's just how we develop. And so this idea that there's this third place where people meet, right? Like the first place, and you all put this out there, that the first place is the home, the second place is the workplace. But then there's this third place where gay people are meeting up, and it's allowing people access to an entire community that for so many years we just absolutely didn't have, and that you are now adding this editorial content only fleshes this out more. It's really good stuff, Sean.
Well, thanks for being interested in this conversation. It's super important to me and my team. And we look forward to sharing more with you in the future.
Oh, yeah. So you brought along your girlfriend, your kind of pretty crazy girlfriend. What the hell were you thinking? She never stops drinking. She talks all the time. And now you're running out of money. Yeah, you've been running through the money. Now you just spent your very last dime.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode to get to all of the latest LGBTQ news, so let's get to it. Of course, our thoughts go out to just everybody affected, which includes everybody in this country affected by the horrific shooting there in Las Vegas. Among the many people that were murdered, a gay man was killed in this mass shooting. Cameron Robinson, who was only 28 years old, was shot dead this past weekend during that horrific mass shooting in Vegas with his boyfriend Bobby Eardley, who was 36 years old. Bobby is expected to survive. The couple had been together for 4 years after they met on OkCupid, and a year ago, Cameron moved in with Bob and his three children in St. George, Utah. Bobby gave a heartbreaking tribute to his late boyfriend, saying, quote, "He's my other half. I'm the crazy fly by the seat of your pants. He's the straight-laced and level-headed one, and so many other things. His quirky little smile, his big teeth, his crooked sunglasses, so many things." So just heartbreaking. Absolutely, absolutely heartbreaking. And just all of our thoughts go out to everybody affected. Heartbreaking story. Can't say it enough. You know, one more piece of this horrific shooting in Las Vegas. Thousands of people in Nevada, after hearing about what had happened, headed for the nearest blood bank. The lines were hundreds deep, snaking around city blocks as people performed one of the only tangible acts, right? Like, what can I do? What can I do to support this? People are calling for gun control legislation. People are calling for mental health screenings and all these different pieces. But one thing that you know that you can do is I can go give blood where blood is so badly needed. But, of course, when it came to one key LGBT group, this was impossible because gay men, we cannot donate blood. So there's been a lot of outcry about the fact that that couldn't happen. Most notably, it came up with Lance Bass. According to People magazine, Lance Bass was compelled to donate blood to help some of the 527 concert goers injured during the Las Vegas shooting, but the Federal Drug Administration prevents men who have had sex with other men within the past 12 months, which prevents Lance Bass, who is openly gay and married to his husband Michael Turchin, from donating. Lance Bass wrote on his Twitter account this, quote, "How is it still illegal for gays to donate blood? I want to donate and I'm not allowed." Other gay men spoke out about the ban in the wake of the Las Vegas tragedy. One user wrote this, quote, "Antiquated, homophobic standards prevent gay men like me from donating life-saving blood." LGBT advocate, writer, and speaker Shane Bitney Crone wrote this, quote, "It infuriates me that gay and bisexual men can be turned away from donating blood in Las Vegas because of the US FDA's discriminatory policy." And again, we all need to be on the same page about this. According to the FDA, their decision to make men who have had sex with other men defer for 12 months from their most recent sexual contact before they donate blood. It is based on several years of research and recent Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data on HIV. The policy was originally put in place back in 1983. It was a lifetime ban, and then just a few years ago, they changed it to a one-year ban on sexual activity. And certainly, I wrote on my Facebook about that in the wake of the Las Vegas tragedy, how ridiculous it was that I would love to be able to give blood. I have that blood, guys. I have that type of blood that will save all of you. I'm the universal donor. If any of you get sick, you definitely want my blood. But I am not allowed to do so. And the idea that even for college students, right, I've been pushing my college students to think about giving blood, but at the same time, it's a little bit not feasible for a college student to be thinking, possibly be involved in any type of sexual act and think, you know what, I got to stop this. And not just college student, I feel like I'm sexualizing college students, any human being who's involved in a sexual act, for them to stop in that moment and say, oh, I'm sorry, I actually can't do this because I would like to donate blood in a year. Right? That's just not something that's actually going to happen. So we've learned so much more about transmission, but still in 2015, we have this 12-month ban, and the FDA stand by their decision. Their last quote was this, quote, "At present, there are insufficient scientific data available to determine whether it is safe to rely only on individual behavioral risk factors when determining donation eligibility. The Red Cross continues to work with the FDA and our blood industry partners to gather additional scientific risk data to assist the FDA in determining if further changes are warranted in the future." So they are sticking by that policy, but at the same time, if you wanted to donate blood and you are a gay man who's had sex within the past year, you could not donate blood. And Lance Bass spoke out about it. I encourage everybody to speak out about it. I will tell you, I had a really lovely exchange when I put that up on my Facebook, when I heard about the Las Vegas tragedy and there were all these calls for people to go donate blood. I was thinking, gosh, I want to do that. I would like to go donate blood. And of course, I remembered, which is never too far from my mind, I can't. So I put on my Facebook wall that I wish that my federal government didn't ban me from donating blood because I would totally do it. And I added the sentence, if you can donate, please do. And one student who saw this on Facebook wrote to me and said, you know what, I've never donated blood in my life. I'm petrified of needles, but I saw what you wrote there, and I'm going to go give blood for the first time. So when you use your voice in that way, you think that, wow, what is this going to do? And I certainly didn't put up a Facebook post. I was actually in some ways just trying to educate more people. I thought, hey, every time I have this conversation, there's always one person who didn't know that there's this ban on gay men giving blood. So I thought maybe I'll put up another Facebook post and also just do some venting of my energy of feeling really helpless in the wake of tragedy, thinking maybe one person will learn that there's this ban that they didn't know about. What I did not see coming was that a student would say, hey, you know what? I am going to go donate blood now. So there are good outcomes. There are good outcomes even in the face of tragedy when you use your voice, and that is not nothing. The U.S. government is insisting it agrees with abolishing the death penalty for homosexuality, despite voting against a United Nations resolution on the issues. The United States sided with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq in voting against a measure at the United Nations Human Rights Council that condemned the imposition of the death penalty for homosexuality. The motion, which passed despite the U.S. opposition, condemned the use of the death penalty arbitrarily or in a discriminatory manner, including for homosexuality. This motion called for the death penalty to be banned as a sanction for specific forms of conduct, such as blasphemy, adultery, and consensual same-sex relations, as well as criticizing its use on minors, mentally ill people, and pregnant women. LGBT activists branded the U.S. vote beyond disgraceful and accused the Trump administration of showing a blatant disregard for human rights and LGBTQ lives around the world. But the State Department is insisting that it had broader concerns with the resolution, which was critical of the death penalty as a whole. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert told reporters, quote, "There was a vote at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, and we've seen a lot of reporting about that. Press releases that have criticized the U.S. government's vote at the Human Rights Council on the question of the death penalty. The headlines and much of the reporting that has come out of that has been misleading. leading. As our representative to the Human Rights Council said on Friday, last Friday, the United States is disappointed to have voted against that resolution. We voted against that resolution because of broader concerns with the resolution's approach in condemning the death penalty in all circumstances, and it called for the abolition of the death penalty altogether. We'd hoped for a balanced and inclusive resolution that would better reflect the positions of states that continue to apply the death penalty lawfully, as the United States does. The United States unequivocally condemns the application of the death penalty for conduct such as homosexuality, blasphemy, adultery, and apostasy. We do not consider such conduct appropriate for criminalization. So there you go. But the problem with that explanation, and by the way, right, like if you hear that explanation, it makes sense. Okay, they were not voting specifically against applying the death penalty to homosexuality. They had broader concerns. The difficulty was the spokesperson for that Human Rights Council wasn't able to cite any exact language in the resolution that she was opposed to. She said, quote, "I don't have it in front of me, but I can just say that if they wanted to apply the death penalty for homosexuality, blasphemy, adultery, etc., 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 we would absolutely oppose the use of the death penalty in those cases." So Ty Cobb, the director of the Human Rights Campaign Global, told Pink News this, quote, "Ambassador Haley has failed the LGBTQ community by not standing up against the barbaric use of the death penalty to punish individuals in same-sex relationships. While the UN Human Rights Council took this crucially important step, the Trump-Pence administration failed to show leadership on the world stage by not championing this critical measure. This administration's blatant disregard for human rights and LGBTQ lives around the world is beyond disgraceful." So that is the United States voting against a measure at the United Nations Human Rights Council, siding with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq in a measure that did pass. It did pass, right? Like, that's the important part of the story. We should be saying, hey, a great story here. The United Nations has voted to condemn the use of the death penalty in cases involving consensual same-sex relationships. But the flip side of that story is that the United States voted against such a motion. LGBT students and employees could lose protection from harassment in a Tennessee county if a planned change in policy goes ahead. The Knox School Board has floated plans to alter their anti-harassment policy from one which explicitly mentions LGBT protections to one that, of course, does not. The plans have been under discussion since last month and are going to be voted on at a school board meeting on October 11th. Students have protested the proposed changes at two schools in the area. Members of the Gay Straight Alliance at Bearden High School held a protest calling for the wording to remain the same. A similar in-school protest was held at Equality Club at the LNN STEM Academy. Jenna Rochelson, who is a 16-year-old student, said this, quote, "I am a bisexual person, and to know that if I were harassed on Knox County School's property, that I am not legally protected on the basis of my sexual orientation, but only on sex, which only refers to biological sex of a person, I feel like my protections are being taken away, and that's really scary." While the school board maintains that the policy itself is not being altered, such protests from LGBT activists could force a U-turn. Currently, the policy refers to sexual orientation and has the phrase actual or perceived gender, which is thought to cover transgender students, teachers, and other school employees. But these phrases have been replaced by sex, the word sex, in this proposed change. And while the school says nothing will be changed, LGBT advocates have disagreed. So that is happening in a county in Texas. Last Thursday night, I watched Will and Grace. Did you all watch Will and Grace? The revival of Will and Grace drew very impressive numbers after their first episode aired. 10.2 million viewers watched it when it debuted last Thursday night. It was massive ratings. The numbers mean that the show drew the biggest numbers to NBC since The Office back in 2013. So quite a market there for Will and Grace. I was one of them. The show also got a 3.0 rating amid 18 to 49-year-olds, which we know is a very important demographic. It beat its own record of 9.8 million people watching in September of 2005 for their season 8 premiere. I mean, they really shattered that record by hundreds of thousands of viewers. The first episode of the sitcom's long-awaited revival reunited all the original cast members, and they were on the attack. They took on the Trump administration. The episode took aim at the Republicans, the Trump administration, the White House, Washington, just everybody. That was a quick-fire episode, and they really let everybody everybody have it. So it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool to watch. I will be watching again this week. I encourage you to do the same thing. Now, you're thinking, why am I advertising for Will and Grace? Because, my friends, and we talk about this all the time, when we prove that there is a market for LGBTQ content, more LGBTQ content gets made. That's how the industry works. I am not saying that all the LGBTQ content out there is the best ever. Of course it's not, because there is a dearth of it. We don't have a ton of it. And so one of the ways that we create more is to support all of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters who are making this content and putting this content out there and really supporting them. I have seen incredible movies over the past, 10 years of doing this show just by supporting LGBTQ artists and what it is that they do. And then that then shows the industry and the advertisers that there is a market and more of this content gets made. Case in point, Star Trek Discovery. Star Trek Discovery, the new Star Trek TV series, is about to debut a same-sex couple for the first time. It was announced earlier this year that Discovery would feature the first gay couple on Star Trek in their 51-year history, and stars Anthony Rapp and Wilson Cruz also spoke out about playing a gay couple on the new Star Trek TV series. The third episode is going to be available this week, so if you haven't watched it, you must watch it. Anthony Rapp told Entertainment Weekly this quote, "I'm really excited and happy when a gay character is a part of a story, especially when a gay character is created in a complex and human and non-stereotypical interesting way, and that has certainly been the case with my character, and you get to see his relationship." He added this, Anthony Rapp added this quote, "There was a little glimpse of a relationship with Sulu in Star Trek Beyond, and it was a nice nod, but in this case, we actually get to see me with my partner in conversation in our living quarters. You get to see our relationship over time treated as any other relationship would be treated." I love that. I love reading that. Rent star Anthony Rapp, he plays science officer and fungal expert Lieutenant Stamets, while Wilson Cruz will play his partner, medical officer Dr. Hugh Culber. They both, again, opened up about this experience. Anthony Rapp went on to say this quote, "This is the first time two human beings who are in love with each other as the same gender has happened on Star Trek. Even more so, that's significant, is the fact that he's Latino and I'm white. These are just factors, and then you get to know us as human beings on the ship, as all the other human beings on the ship are. We're also colleagues. He's a medical officer, I'm a science officer, and our work intersects sometimes. All that stuff is just part of the fabric of it. I believe everybody will be happy with the humanity of how our relationship is expressed. The storyline affects our relationship, and the relationship may affect some decisions that are made, but the fact that it's two men in a relationship is not the focal point of any storyline." I love that. Wilson Cruz added this quote, "It enriches the storyline. The crux of my journey is how I balance my responsibilities as the ship's doctor with my responsibilities to the person I love, and how these two ideas can come into conflict at times." Very, very exciting stuff. I need to check it out. I got to practice what I preach. I have not yet watched this new iteration of Star Trek. So if you guys have watched it and you have feedback on it, I would love to hear about that. Send me an email, ken@thisshowisogay.com. Would love to hear about that. Former UFC heavyweight champion Fabricio Werdum has said he will undertake an LGBTQ community outreach project after he used an anti-gay slur. He used a Spanish derogatory term for a gay man in a heated exchange with UFC lightweight Tony Ferguson. The term is comparable to that F-word here in English. The exchange took place last week after a media launch for UFC 216, and I can't repeat what he said, but it was pretty bad. He has since apologized for using that word and said he did not mean to offend anyone. He tweeted that it is a common word in Spanish culture, and I do not mean to offend anyone in the LBG community, and if I did, I'm apologetic. He will now undertake a community outreach project. The statement read this, quote, "The UFC organization is disappointed with recent comments made by Fabricio Werdum at a promotional event in Los Angeles. The nature and implication of his comments do not reflect UFC's views and will not be tolerated, no matter the manner which they they are used. We acknowledge and appreciate that Fabrizio has since apologized to the organization and to anyone he may have offended with his words. As high-profile athletes, role models, and global ambassadors of the sport of mixed martial arts, athletes under contract with UFC are required to abide by the athlete conduct policy. Given his breach of this policy, Fabrizio has agreed to perform community outreach within the LGBTQ community in Las Vegas, taking steps to enact change and make a direct impact within the community. I love reading things like that. Years ago, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post. I don't even remember who did something offensive, but some celebrity or some athlete did something offensive. They said something anti-gay, and they immediately apologized, and everything was like, all right, well, I guess everything should be okay. No, apologies made within hours of you saying something offensive, those are meaningless. There has to be some sort of commitment to action. There has to be some sort of process that you undertake to understand the impact of your words. I don't want to hear about your intent. I don't want to hear about the fact that the word that you used is common in Spanish. That's about intent. It's not about intent. It's about impact. It is not about intent, it is about impact. And you can't possibly appreciate the impact that you have had unless you actually take some time to understand the community, right? And so as this mixed martial arts star is going to do, he's going to take the time and do some outreach. And then hopefully he's going to release another statement and say, I appreciate things in a completely different way. We'll see. We'll absolutely see what happens. Let's go back to talking about the Trump administration. Sam Brownback, who is in line to be ambassador at large for international religious freedom, he this week defended his decision as the governor of Kansas to scrap an order that barred discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. In 2015, then-Governor Brownback rescinded the order issued in August of 2007 by then-Governor Kathleen Sebelius that banned discrimination against gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender individuals in hiring and employment agencies under the governor's direct control. He told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at his confirmation hearing that Sebelius, a Democrat, had acted unilaterally and undercut the Kansas legislature. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, a former Virginia governor, asked Brownback whether such an order sends a clear signal to a state's agency chiefs that discrimination based on sexual orientation won't be tolerated, and Brownback responded this quote, I think that would be a rational thing. I just don't think it's a right that the executive branch should create without the legislative branch. Brownback, who is a favorite of Christian conservatives for his strong stances against abortion and same-sex marriage, also declined to unequivocally declare that there is no situation that would allow a country to cite religious freedoms as the basis for criminally prosecuting LGBT people. He said this in response to that question from Tim Kaine, quote, I don't know what that would be in what circumstance. He then pledged to continue the policies that have been done in the prior administration in working on these international issues. Tim Kaine said he expected an unambiguous answer. The senator said there are still countries around the world where you can be imprisoned and even executed if you are LGBT. But yes, Brownback did not give a unilateral, unequivocal answer, but he is in line to have a pretty big post there with the United States government. Let's turn to the state of Florida. Miami-Dade commissioners this week rejected a ban on gay conversion therapy for minors, saying the proposed crackdown would thrust local government into a parent's right to make decisions about a child's mental health and address matters of sexuality within the family. The 4-7 vote followed hours of public testimony, most of it from opponents of the proposed ordinance by Commissioner Sally Heyman. Supporters wanted Miami-Dade to join a list of local governments banning the discredited and fraudulent practice of trying to change a child's sexual orientation, but critics saw the ordinance as so broadly worded that it could ensnare a pastor's sermon or a parent expressing concerns about a child's choices on sexual activity. Commissioner Rebecca Sosa said this, quote, in this case, my problem is with the rights of parents. If you make a decision about your children that in the end is wrong, that's your responsibility. I think the government has to be respectful of that right. So the ordinance would have applied only to counselors operating outside of city limits in Miami-Dade, since the commission has direct authority over local regulations for the county's unincorporated areas. Miami, Miami Beach, and other cities have already enacted local bans on conversion therapy, and the commission vote marks a significant victory for the churches and advocacy groups fighting the restrictions across the country. Again, this is a practice conversion therapy that has proven to not work. It has been proven over and over again that it in no way changes anyone's sexual orientation. It in no way changes anyone's gender identity. And in fact, not only is it fraudulent because it does not change sexual orientation, it does not change gender identity, but additionally, it does actual harm. It increases rates of depression and anxiety and inclinations towards suicide. These things actually happen because minors are being subjected to a practice that does not work. They are being told that they are wrong. They are being told that they are broken. They are being told that they need to be fixed, and conversion therapy can fix them. And it can't do that, but the very practice of it does actual harm. So a little bit disappointing there in Miami-Dade County that they were not able to continue to outlaw this practice as it applies to these agencies where it is not currently outlawed. Got to fight this. We have to fight this. There's still, I think, 41 states in the country where it is still legal, where conversion therapy is still legal. It is only a handful of states, a very small minority of states, where they have outlawed conversion therapy. And they've done so by saying it is fraudulent. It is harmful. We do not allow parents to make an irresponsible decision like this. Do I think that parents should bear responsibility for the decisions? Absolutely. But I also think that the government does step in abusive situations. And a situation like this that involves conversion therapy for a minor, that absolutely is abuse. It absolutely is. So to say that, oh, it's just the parents can do whatever they want, it's their decision, no, that's not true. That's absolutely not true. I'm not a fan of the federal government being in our bedrooms, right? That's not what I'm advocating for. But if the government knows that something harmful is happening, something that is causing great, great harm and damage to minors, yes, we do have a responsibility to step in. That's not just on parents. There you go. Back to the Trump administration, a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, because we got to talk about this guy every single week until this election happens. A Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate has now praised Russia's gay propaganda law. This is what we have now found out, that Roy Moore there, who is running for Attorney General Jeff Sessions' seat in the great state of Alabama, he has said some really horrible things, and they are coming to light more and more, despite a string of controversies surrounding his abhorrent views about LGBT rights. President Trump has thrown his support behind Roy Moore, who will go head-to-head with Democratic candidate Doug Jones. It emerged this week that Moore has praised the so-called gay propaganda law in Russia, which outlaws speech relating to LGBT rights. The law has been criticized by human rights bodies as an abuse of power and a brazen attack on free speech. But apparently, that's fine with Roy Moore. CNN's K-File found that Roy Moore's political Facebook page had shared a 2015 article by anti-LGBT website Barbwire titled "Conservative Russians Give Moral Lesson to Facebook's Homosexual Propaganda." The article addressed Russian efforts to ban a Facebook Pride profile picture filter in the country under the gay propaganda law. It lavished praise on the country for its, quote, strong stance in defense of traditional family values by passing what is commonly referred to as the law against gay propaganda to jail insolent demonstrators. So Roy Moore endorsed that by posting it on his Facebook page. Elsewhere on his Facebook page, Roy Moore criticized local officials for permitting pride parades to take place, and he shared posts claiming that gay people have fabricated all instances, not just some, but all instances of homophobic hate crimes. Moore is on record previously saying that homosexual conduct should be illegal, and he's done all of these other really horrible anti-gay things, but still, he won the Republican nomination to replace Jeff Sessions there as the senator, one of the 100 senators, one of the two from Alabama, but he would be one of the overall 100 U.S. senators. He would be representing the state of Alabama. Holy cow, folks. Just keep sharing what this guy has said in the past, because it is not good stuff. Can we please end on one happy story? Let's try it. Texas and the church aren't often known for their progressive nature, but one church in Austin has decided to take a significant stand on LGBTQ rights. The First United Methodist Church there in Austin has this month announced that they will no longer hold any weddings until they are permitted to hold same-sex ceremonies. Additionally, the church's clergy will not hold any wedding ceremonies off-site, though blessings, counseling, and other ceremonies for either same-sex or straight couples are permitted. Any weddings already booked before the announcement was made will still take place, but no new bookings will be taken. The church held a vote among its congregation last month, and a massive 93% agreed with the resolution. Given the support among the congregation, the question is why the church cannot simply hold the ceremonies. Well, the reason is because their national denomination, the United Methodist Church, does not allow its clergy to perform same-sex wedding ceremonies, nor allow same-sex couples to be wed on its church property. According to the United Methodist Church stated social principles, quote, "We affirm the sanctity of the marriage covenant that is expressed in love, mutual support, personal commitment, and shared fidelity between a man and a woman." So this is one church who is saying, okay, that may be so, but then nobody is getting married here. Reverend Taylor Fuerst said this, quote, "I had plenty of conversations with people who were struggling with this conversation. Everyone from folks who are still in disagreement with our church's stance on full inclusion to folks who agree with that, but were uncomfortable changing our practice. It's one thing to say this is what we believe, but it's another to, if you're a straight person, give something up." Amazing stuff. In response to the decision, the United Methodist Church's regional body, the Rio, Texas Annual Conference, said it would not be taking a position on the resolution. That is one church standing up and saying, look, if our congregants, if our same-sex congregants cannot get married here, then right this second, no one can get married here. There it is. There it is. So, some happy news to end on. I don't know that that's really happy news. I guess it's happy news that people are taking action, and we like to see people taking action. That is always a good thing. And I encourage you to get out there and go take some action. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference. I don't know what it is. Again, I learned that you could put up a Facebook post and it can change lives. Someone's donating blood because I took 2 seconds and wrote a Facebook post. You could do that. Use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference. Please get out there, folks, and put on your cape and make a difference. And while you are out there inspiring the masses, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? When you're in a 1955 Chevy Bel Air and you're cruising the Malecon, oh, all your troubles are gone. When you're in a 1955 Chevy Bel Air and you're cruising La Petite Place, wonderful place. Yes, it is. And you're driving with the top down. You're in the sunshine with the top down. Yeah, you're rolling in a carriage that is the perfect marriage of vinyl and chrome. You got the white walls and the tail fins, the two-tone color and the tail fins. Salsa on the AM station. Why end this vacation? Why ever go home? 'Cause when you're in a 1955 Chevy Bel Air and you're cruising the Malecon, oh, all your troubles are gone. When you're in a 1955 Chevy Bel Air and you're cruising La Petite Place, oh, world's a wonderful place. As you roll past La Zora El Cuervo, smile and let every last care go, floating away on the music in your ears. As you roll past La Milla Cohiba, your girlfriend gets out and says, see ya. Yeah, she's over it, she's had enough. You don't care because now you're in love.